Hi, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. Welcome to Letting Go with Guy Finley. Guy is the best-selling author of Let Go and Live in the Now and is the founding director of nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. And now, here's Guy Finley.
What we're going to do for the next roughly 60 minutes is we're going to take everything apart. We're going to look at the whole of our lives so that we can begin to understand, if we do it properly, if we're successful in examining the evidence of our own life, so that we can begin to let a different kind of intelligence help us to put together what we clearly have not been able to put together in a way that brings us what our heart longs for. You look at human beings, and you don't have to go very far. The mirror would be best, but turn on a television, listen to a radio show, read a report of a celebrity or someone in the news, and you'd be flabbergasted. My mind suddenly recalls something that someone sent to me, and it talked about, and I don't remember the number, but something like, I'm going to pick a figure, one-third of these 200 people actually have done something criminal. And when you get to the end of it, you're reading about the Congress. I don't make that up. These are the most, supposedly the most important, influential, intelligent, and wise human beings on the planet. The elected officials. Then I won't even get into the debacle of present-day religion. You just don't have to be an Einstein to realize something's not right. But unlike the rest of the world that points its finger at what's wrong so that the one pointing can be right for pointing it out, we don't do that. We want to understand what our role is in this world that's slowly crashing. We want to understand why our own world has the wrecks in it than it does. And you can't talk about these things without bringing in some ideas that when a person first hears them, because of the way in which their inner life is presently constituted. What does that mean, their inner life is presently constituted? The way they think, the way they feel, the way that person responds to life mechanically, habitually. What a person takes to be familiar and good. This is at the root of the problem. And if you can understand that the root of the problem has to do with a human being normally takes as being familiar and good to him or her, then you can see we really have quite an uphill road, don't we? We have to look at ourselves and recognize that there is something in us every day, all the time, pursuing things that it believes is right and good for it. And then that same human being has to, the next day or week or moment later, reconcile how what is right and good for it could lead to something that wrecked the day for it or for someone else. I mean, that's really staggering. If a person could actually see that the sum effect of the suffering in my life, and let me tell you, you don't want anybody else to know, but it is known. Human beings are, what did Thoreau say, lead lives of secret and quiet despair. Everyone finding ways to hide from the world around them. Just how much aching there and emptiness there is in their heart. Well, it's not supposed to be like that. It doesn't have to be like that. But a radical, and it's not a bad word, a radical change has to occur in a person's thinking. And that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk a little bit about what it means to let go. We're going to talk a little bit about what it means to live in the present moment, in the now. But we're not going to talk about these things the way that human beings like to talk about them, which is in a dream. Dreaming about letting go of things so that they can fulfill the dream of being free. Freedom isn't a dream. Talking about living in the present moment so that they can escape the pain of their past regrets or the fears of the future is expected. But the now, the present moment, it is not an idea. It is not a time to come. It isn't something that is fulfilled through the course of things moving in a certain way. These things connected with letting go and living in the now, you can't separate the two. You can't separate what it means to live in the present moment from letting go of one's self as one is presently constituted. And by that constitution, I mean the nature in us that's in conflict with everything and anything that doesn't confirm us as we want to be confirmed. So here's the first staggering idea. At least I think it's staggering. You can tell me. Come awake now. What if I told you that your life... Oh, and by the way, I better tell you in front. This is good, what I'm going to say. This is good. Your life, my life, it is supposed to be consistently challenged. Consistently challenged. Never a moment without a challenge in it. You go, oh, no. This is the wrong talk for me. He obviously doesn't live with me. That's all I have is challenges. I'm not talking about the kind of challenges that you face. Because the challenges that you face day to day, and the reason that they frighten you, the idea of, you know, if you look at life, isn't this what most people are trying to do? I'm trying to get to a place where I get everything so lined up, I'm in so much control of all the people around me, I have so much money and such a nice body that I have no more challenges. Isn't that about it? Everything just comes. I conquered the world. What are the stupid movie, Titanic? I'm the king of the world. On the Titanic, by the way. Oh, no. Oh, what you're missing. Oh, what you're intended to be a part of. Because you see, the reason the idea of a being challenged moment to moment to moment in life, the reason it's unpleasant to us, because essentially we are all the time challenged now by the fear of loss, by the fear of having to get up and pursue again what I pursued yesterday that didn't fulfill the promise that set me on that pursuit. So I don't want any more. Should we all whine together? I don't want any more challenges. Now, maybe when you're 15 or 18 or 22 years old, you may still think to yourself, you know, I'm gonna grab that golden ring on that merry-go-round because, yeah, I grabbed it once or twice, and sure, it turned my hand a little bit green, but I just didn't grab the right ring. So I don't mind riding on the merry-go-round because I don't really see it as a merry-go-round. I see it as only something going in a fairly straight line that's headed towards what I believe is going to make my life enriched. But the fact of the matter is, and it's better to learn it and learn the truth about it, than to continue to make the same mistakes. And the mistake is that we have become dull human beings. Dull. In case this isn't clear, you've become a dull human being. You are a dull human being. Now, I know some of you may think you're the life of the party, but that's not what I mean by being dull. By being dull, I mean that we've become numb. We've become disenfranchised. And it happens to us over time. Little by little by little, we're sown into this world, and our mother and our father want us to become this, and we look at the world, and there's the president, and anybody can become president. And we look around, and we see firemen, and we see Indian chiefs and lawyers, and we look at all this and say, ah, man, I'm going to become something. I'm going to get the rewards of this world. And that's what we do, because we don't know any better. There is no education available on this planet at present that teaches a child, when it's necessary that a child be taught, that one can't fulfill themselves through what the world says does the fulfilling. We're not taught that. We're taught that we're fulfilled through the accomplishment of achieving rewards that the world recognizes as being significant. So that in becoming strong and powerful and an authority of some kind, in winning the accolades of our peers, that these are the rewards that we as human beings are taught, are what we must challenge ourselves to go forward and to get. But if we look at it, and I'm asking you to look at this, at a certain point, I'll ask you, how many of you have had some of the rewards? All of us have. To one degree or another, you've had the reward. And this is what I was thinking about. If a reward was a reward, wouldn't it stay a reward? I mean, please just think, oh yeah, I like this. Think for yourself. Think for yourself. Don't let the world's mind do your thinking. It's killing you with dullness, with defeat, with despair, with discouragement. Think for yourself. Let's see. He said, if a reward was a real reward, wouldn't it remain a reward? Well, of course that makes sense. If I get a reward, how come it turns to trash in my hand? And let's clarify that. Here I am. I'm a man, a woman set out in this world, and I want the rewards. What else do I do? I set out my purposes. My purpose in life is defined by the meaning I am given as a child. And I don't know any other meaning apart from that which I saw everyone else address themselves with and in as the meaning. And I looked at my mother and my father, and I looked at their mother and father, and all the way down the line, and I saw very clearly that what it meant to be a successful human being was to somehow receive rewards in this world that everyone else around me recognized as being a reward. And the more people that recognize it as being a reward, the bigger the reward it is.
Love, the brightest and most powerful force in the universe. Love melts stress and cancels resentment. It gives birth to kindness and is the fuel of success. Love is at the heart of every great relationship and is the true essence of lasting peace. In his new book, Apprentice of the Heart, best-selling author Guy Finley explores lessons in life only love can teach. This breakthrough book contains the tools you need to strengthen and deepen all of your relationships with family, friends, coworkers, and with the present moment itself. Apprentice of the Heart, available now at guyfinley.com and fine bookstores everywhere. Joseph Polansky of Diamond Fire magazine writes, "The reader is lifted up to a whole new realm, a rarefied region of the soul." To order your copy of Guy Finley's Apprentice of the Heart, visit guyfinley.com. That's guyfinley.com. The relationship your heart longs for already exists.
So if a reward is a reward, how come so many human beings that you see all the time around you, and if not around you, in the news, in the television, why does that reward that they receive from the world turn out to be a millstone around their neck that causes them to sacrifice their dignity, to sell their soul, and ultimately to begin to live a life with no love in it apart from the appearance of acting loving so that they can remain in the eyes of others as though they still have the reward? Nobody knows how much they don't have the reward than those who have lost it once the world's granted it to them. I can assure you that. But then because they want the world to continue to see them as having won that reward, they'll walk around with their badge, their blue ribbon, with their gold medal around their neck. And it's a weight because they know it's empty. On the other side, if loss in this world was real loss, how is it that some human beings can suffer the most terrible loss in the world? You talk about a punishment. Forget reward. How about punishment? Here's a man, here's a woman, and he comes into this life, she comes into life, and nothing goes right. And how is it that someone who receives no reward from this world but receives only what the world sees as a punishment, how is it that that person can wind up wise and exalted, true and kind and compassionate? A true individual who is a light in the world, but who was given no light according to the world when they were born, or that they received through the world and its efforts. I'm trying at the outset of this talk to put into your mind a very necessary doubt. Because you see, as we are, we have no doubts. We live with a doubtless nature. It doesn't doubt that what we set out to win in terms of rewards for ourselves, the accolades, the approval, it doesn't doubt that that's the right thing for us to be doing with our lives. It never questions that more isn't actually more. Even though the evidence of our lives points absolutely to the fact that more isn't more, that more becomes more like a pain. A problem, a weight, a grief, the source of a fear, and a constant sense of I've got to take care of what I've got now because I've vested so much of my life into seeing that people see I have more that if I were to leave it, I would be less for what I am. What a tragedy that is. So we stand on the threshold here of a very important question, and that is, if indeed the challenges that are before us now that we have all become just worn out by. Gosh, do you know that? How many of you understand this at all? That just going out's a challenge. I mean, just getting out of your house because you gotta put on makeup. And I don't know whether the ladies think that way or not. You gotta look right. You gotta walk into a store and you have to be pleasant. Talk about a challenge. You have to think about over and over and over again everything you have to do in order to keep everything in place. Talk about a challenge. No wonder the drug industry is the largest business on this planet. Those aren't the challenges I'm talking about. And when a person begins to recognize that they have accepted a challenge, a gauntlet that was thrown down in front of them from the beginning of time on this planet by a world that has no idea of its own purpose, because the people on it have no idea how to fulfill themselves, then you're ready to begin asking certain questions and to understand, well, if that's not the challenge, if the challenge isn't to become someone in this world, to win its rewards so that I'm accordingly recognized, if that's not the challenge, what is? Here it is. Take a breath and tell a story now. There was once a great, what should we call him, wood carver. How many of you are unimpressed already? A great wood carver. Oh, what this man could do with his knives and wood. Whether it was the trunk of a tree or a small block of wood, he was able to take nature and to craft her into something that whoever looked at what had been crafted by his hand could feel the qualities of that which had been crafted. Such is true art. True art is capturing in nature. This is physical now. We'll talk about spiritual in a moment. Capturing what is real and true and everlasting. Because all forms have a counterpart in a higher world, if you will. And to capture the true form of something, even on this planet, as base as it is to convey to the individual who looks or touches or reads or hears what has been crafted, those same eternal principles. And so a person is actually graced, if they're fortunate enough, to find something. And this woodcarver was a master of this, I tell you. And because of that, he did attract to himself not many students. Now, you would think that a master woodcarver would attract a lot of students, wouldn't you? Because everybody wants what's true, right? Wrong. People want what's made in Hong Kong. It rhymes. Right? Wrong. They want what's in Hong Kong. They want knockoffs. And do you know why people want knockoffs? Because it gives them the sensation of possession without ever having to pay for the true cost of it. So this woodcarver, who was a master, did attract a few students. And over the years of working with this master, slowly but surely, one or two of them began to show signs of understanding the woodcarver's secret. And the day came when it was time to graduate. And just so you don't understand, you needn't fear this idea, because we are all the time, if we're willing, we are all the time at the threshold of the school in which it's possible for us to understand what this one student, who was to go on and become a master himself, learned. And so the day came. The student graduated. The teacher said to the student, "Would you tell the other students what it is that you finally learned that made you the master of your craft?" Translation, that made you the master of your life. Do you understand? That allowed you to understand the nature of happiness, that allowed you to understand the nature of confidence, of strength, of contentment. Tell us, please, what it was that you finally learned. He said, "Well, I suspected this," the student said, "for many years, but it wasn't until just a little while ago that I began to see that not only did I suspect what was true, but there was something in me that wouldn't let me confirm my suspicion, and that was the delay in my learning what it was that I had to learn." He said, "Because in the end, this is what I learned. Everywhere I cut into the grain of wood, it's different. That's what I learned. That I couldn't cut into a piece of wood, that I didn't cut into a piece of wood that was different than the wood I cut into a moment before. That the grain that runs through the wood is different in all places in the wood, and therefore it can never be met with anything other than a hand wielding a knife that understands the grain is different everywhere one cuts into it." Now, in case the subtlety of that spiritual story isn't clear to you, I will tell you something of what it means before I go on. The challenge of life is to not only understand, because you're present to yourself, and because of that presence in the moment, your ability to meet life and its challenges. The challenge of life is to understand that every moment of life is a different grain of it. There's no moment where, in this life of yours, you aren't standing at something that you weren't standing at before. There's no moment in this life where, if you want to use the word, the river, the whole of the movement of life, hasn't taken on a different grain, a different texture, a different color, a different strength, a different kind of wood, if you will. But we don't know anything about that. Life to us is just get an axe, man. Cut it down, build what you need out of it, and get on with it. There's no sweetness in a life like that because the individual has sacrificed. Now we're going to come to a key idea. Because the individual has sacrificed the sensitivity that it takes to be present to the moment and what the moment is asking. They've sacrificed the sensitivity of that for the seeming satisfaction of being able to come up with something that is familiar, that is known and recognized, and able to give that individual the familiar same sense of their life. See, we're creatures of two worlds. We're kind of, in a way, on one hand, it's the earth and our own life represent a very unique meeting point. On one hand, they're all of us, it's natural to us, in quotes, to want things to remain the same. How many of you know you want things to remain the same? But on the other side, I don't want things to remain the same. I'm bored to death with things remaining the same. I want things to change. So what happens to a consciousness that on one side of it, it wants nothing to change? It'll fight with everything. It'll try to control whatever. No, 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 no change. No change, no, no change, no change. And the other side, God, I'm bored. I want change, real change. When will things change? Things aren't changing enough. Do you know what happens to such a mind that's divided like that? It becomes dull. It becomes dull. Fists pounding together. Thoughts pounding together. On one hand, I want. On the other hand, I don't want. Every day, that same mind looking out, and whatever comes along that doesn't fit the change that it wants, it fights with. And then when it does fit the change that it wants, it doesn't see that whatever change it wanted, it had already preconceived. And it preconceived it from what it had been before, so it was bored with the change that it was able to make for itself. How many of you can see what I'm talking about? And there's, what a pain. What a terrible pain, because here we are. The right part of us understands. Things are supposed to change. I know that there is a river of life. I don't stand in it. I want to, but I know there's a river of life. I've had moments where I stood outside, maybe on a clear day or an evening when the sun had set and the moon wasn't up, and I looked at the stars, or I was at the beach, or I had a moment. And I know in that split second that I was able to be touched by something that was alive in a way that I wasn't. I know there's a life greater than my own. And when a person has moments like that, it's natural that they want to have that sense of being alive all the time. I want to live. You know what's wrong with you? You're identified with the parts of you that tell you over and over again that you must never let people see that you're unhappy, that you don't have a life. That's what's wrong with you. Every single one of you, and listening to this tape, you're so afraid, not of what other people think, but of admitting to yourself that you don't have a life. And the reason I say that now is because it's only when a person begins to understand that they don't have a life that they begin to question the parts of themselves that have produced that for them. And it isn't until we can question the parts of ourselves and the meaning that those parts have ascribed to life that it becomes possible for us to change the purpose. Because don't you see that the purpose of my life day in and day out is predicated on the meaning that my mind and heart is filled with. And the meaning of my life is filled and presently nothing but a compilation of doing all that I can to maintain whatever it is that I think I've won, while at the same time trying to figure out ways to convince myself that this is going to change. That somehow the happiness that's eluded me, I'll find. And let me tell you where happiness is. Happiness is not in what we're going to call now the outcome-oriented life. This is a key phrase in our talk so far. An outcome-oriented life. We live an outcome-oriented life. Now, what is an outcome-oriented life? It's a life that looks at what comes out. I look at what I did. I look at what I'm going to do. I look at what it was manifested by my efforts, and I look at what I've got. And when I look at what I got, I measure myself against what I've got. And if what I've got's pretty good, then I'm pretty good. And if what I've got's not too good, then I'm not too good. If what I've got looks like it's getting better, I'm getting better. If it looks like it's getting worse, my life has taken a turn downhill. And that all of those things connected to an outcome-oriented life have to do with a human being believing that they are somehow equivocal, the same as what they produce in life. If I produce a successful business, if I'm a great author, if I have wonderful children, if I'm the king of the world in Merlin, Oregon, or wherever it is that a person wants to rise to the top where they're recognized and approved of by the society they're a part of, that's an outcome-oriented life. Because according to how I weigh what I am and have done, accordingly I love myself or despise myself. And God forbid, and this is part of why we don't want challenges, because whatever we have put together, if it comes apart, then I'm challenged to put it back together again, because if it doesn't go back together again, it is I that have come apart. So we live in fear. Yes? How many understand? See, that's an outcome-oriented life. We, if we're willing to do it, need to start looking at all of that and say, I do have an outcome-oriented life. I feel good about myself if I'm around people and they smile at me. As long as I have a plan in mind, things aren't too bad. But the moment that something threatens the plan, then I feel pain. And that my life is all about a constant kind of relationship that I have with the things. Now, this is important, that the things of the world that I'm in have said are important. That's what I weigh myself by. That's what I know myself by. And that's what I challenge myself to win and to do and become. Is to somehow be able to look at what I manifest in my life and accordingly know my goodness or my badness, my wealth or my poverty, my success or my failure. And if such things have the capacity, as our mind is presently hypnotized to believe, to give us the sense of ourself that we're searching for, a happiness that can't be knocked apart, if those things had the capacity to do that, don't you think that you would have it by now? Don't you think you'd be able to look and say, you know what, my life, and this is pretty much what we do, my life isn't half bad.
You're listening to Letting Go with Guy Finley. For more information about Guy's life-empowering ideas, visit guyfinley.com. We'll be back in a moment.
One reason the wind of good fortune is often found at the back of people who are successful in life is because these individuals are usually found moving ahead of it in anticipation of its arrival. Hi, this is Dr. Ellen Dickstein. The engaging words of best-selling author Guy Finley remind us that real success in life is a relationship between ourselves and a timeless greatness that lives within us. Each week, you can receive a powerful, life-affirming message from Guy, guaranteed to help you succeed with your wish for a new life. Each brief, uplifting insight reminds you that nothing can stop you from knowing the higher happiness your heart longs for. To receive Guy Finley's free weekly key lessons, just visit guyfinley.com. Join the thousands of grateful individuals who are learning how to make themselves and our world a better place. Visit GuyFinley.com. That's GuyFinley.com.
Welcome back to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley.
Do you know what a good life is? A good life is a life in which you never have to think about yourself again. That's a really good life. You know why? Because you can't think about yourself without producing fear. If you think you're a good person, then all of that's predicated upon whatever you've been able to produce. Now you have to keep in place what you've produced, otherwise you won't be a good person anymore. If you think you're a bad person, then you're certainly afraid that you won't be able to produce what will change those conditions for you. So a person goes through this life with this kind of constant knocking around up in their head and heart, trying to figure out how to become something that they've envisioned as being true and good and a reward. And just because it comes to mind, I'll put this in. Our hope must not be in things seen, but in things unseen. All right. If it's not this life that's connected to an outcome-oriented consciousness, and how many of you understand now what outcome, you know, I lay a plan. I'm going to throw a party. I'm going to throw a party. Now, how many of you know that when you throw a party, that you're either king of the world or you're the clown that from down below? You either succeed or you don't you? Outcome-oriented. Everybody loved the party. I am a party master. Or everybody, they left. In fact, they didn't even come. I'm nothing. It's comical, but it's pathetic. Ask yourself whether or not you want to live from a nature that only knows its value by comparing itself to what the world says is good or bad, and then sends you out to get what the world says will do that, only to find out it did nothing for you. What's the alternative? Here we go. This is connected to the woodcutter story now, because we said that the man who became the next master of the wood carving, who was able to craft life into something beautiful, whatever he touched, was because he understood that wherever he cut into the wood, the grain was different. If it's not an outcome-oriented life that can produce what it is that we in our heart of hearts are looking for, then what is it? We're missing out on what we have as human beings that can give us the capacity to fulfill our potential. We're missing, as I sometimes say, relative to such an idea, we're missing well over half of our life. Well over half of our life. What's the missing half of our life? We're going to call it the incoming life. The incoming life. See the difference? My mind, my heart, everything's connected with weighing myself by the outcome of things. Whether they like me, whether I got there, whether I got it, whether they said it was right, whether they said it was wrong, everything connected outside, everything relative to an image, and this is important, everything relative to an image I have in my mind of what it means to be happy, then comparing that image of what I think will make me happy to what I think just happened. So that now what I am living in is thought. This is the dream world where my life is a constant comparison between what I believe is the reward and whether or not I approximate it through my activities and efforts. And then if they match up, I say I've won the reward, when what I am really doing is being a captive of a dream with no capacity to give me the true feeling of life, the true meaning of life I'm looking for. So where is it? It's in the grain. It's in the grain. Do you know why it was a challenge for that boy to learn to every moment that the wood was different wherever he cut into it? Because it meant that every moment he had to be aware of what he was cutting into. He couldn't take that knife and touch the wood without being, if you will, one with the wood he was cutting into. Because to just cut without being conscious of what the blade was entering into would be to deny the feature and the capacity of that wood to pass along to him what it was capable of doing and becoming, of what it would allow him to understand in relationship with the wood. So it is with life. So it is exactly with life. The incoming moment. Not outward oriented, right? Not outer oriented. Incoming moment is what we're talking about now. Because the incoming moment is, if you will, this now. We're not in relationship with it. We are fully identified, actually ensnared is the proper word, by a nature that is only constituted at the present to derive its sense of self by considering its own images. I know who I am by thinking about what I'm doing. I have a value of myself by measuring it according to what I have been told is valuable and whether or not I'm getting close to that. And that's not life. Real life is when a man or a woman begins to understand that this present moment is not a moment of thought, but a moment of convergence, a moment of certain kinds of energies, of different orders, all of which are pouring into the same moment, and all of us intended to be there, accepting the challenge of what it stirs in us, and then what we do accordingly. Another story. Take a deep breath to get this idea across to you. There was, some time ago, we'll put it back in the maybe 1800s, I believe it was the 1800s, middle to late 1800s, the Manifest Destiny, when people began moving across this great country from the east to the west for the purposes of, well, what should we say, finding freedom, some religious freedom, some economic freedom, the possibility of and it's a nice metaphor, of owning their own piece of land, of being an independent human being, escaping what was already starting to become ugly in the eastern parts where men and women, where it became more and more, if you will, it became clearer and clearer to the culture that what it meant to somehow be a winner was to be recognized as someone who possessed more than your brother or your sister. And people wanted, by and large, to get a chance at that for themselves, but they wanted a life independent of some of that, some of them. So men and women moved west. And this story takes place in one of those areas. And if you could kind of see it like a, well, we could use two expressions. We could use it like a root system moving west, or we could talk about a cancer moving west. But as human beings began to move and colonize, you know, form groups, little towns and villages and cities, you can see that as each one grew, that as it grew, it would reach a certain point and then it would send out a tendril, so to speak, so that something else could be done somewhere else. And our story takes place with a group of people who had moved to a small part of a northwest country where there was, oh, we'll pick a figure, there were 30 people in a 50-mile, square-mile area. Nice. And they would meet, as they did in what was becoming a small village. There'd be a horseshoe fellow, I forget what they call him, not a blacksmith, like a blacksmith, and there was a little store, and there was a place that a wagon was starting to come through from time to time, and they would meet. And there were four men. And these four men would often sit, because they came basically at the same time, and they would toss up a jug of corn liquor, and they would talk about what was going on. And a reporter who was interested in the whole manifest destiny and what people were doing had also moved to that part in order to get the stories firsthand and send it back over the wires that were just going up. And he watched these four men for a while, and basically he was fascinated by one thing. And what it was this. Three of the men were almost always griping about something. Three of the men had a kind of constant comment in the form of a complaint of one thing or another. But the fourth man amongst them didn't have this. And he wondered why, when they all came at the same time, settled in the same place essentially, why one of them seemed to have a certain contentment, a confidence, was able to be compassionate and nice, when the other men, by and large, weren't. So one day he got on his little horse and little buggy, and he trotted out to the place where the fourth man lived that had this contentment that the others didn't. And he pulled up, and by the way, back in those days, from at least 300 yards out, you go, "Howdy, neighbor!" You always identified yourself. And they, "Yeah, hi, can I come and talk to you? You should come on in." He'd come in and pour a cup of coffee. He said, "You know, I want to talk to you about something. I know that the other men that you moved out here with, they're not as happy as you are. They're not as content. Can you tell me why?" He said, "Oh, sure, no problem." He said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well, first," he said, the one man with the older fellow with the beard, he set up his household there, his homestead, on one fork of the stream that has gold in it. And he was quite content when he first set up his place there. But then he found out a little bit later that gold-filled stream was not a perennial stream. It didn't run year-round, and he'd built his home. And now he had some gold, but he didn't have the water that he needed all the time when he wanted it. And the other fellow, he built his house at the headwaters of a stream that had the fish running up. So he thought to himself he'd always have, during the season, a way to be able to provide and set up stores for himself. And the other fellow, he put his place where there was runoff from the cold snows up there, so he knew he'd always have water, but he was unhappy because he didn't have fish and he didn't have gold." And the reporter looked at him and said, "Well, why are you different than those fellows?" He said, "Because I waited and watched, and I found a place where all three streams converge, so that I have the gold and I have the water and I have the year-round water that they don't. We're meant to live where life converges in us. We're meant to live where all of the energies that are pouring into this present moment pour into us, because we're meant to live from a part of ourselves that is the same as that moment, that is the same place. You can call it what you will, the present moment, now. You could call it God's life. You could call it the light of Christ. You could call it the living truth. You could call it eternal wisdom, the flow of eternal wisdom. It makes no difference, the words that you give it. What does matter, and what's critical for us, is to understand that we must begin to recognize that our life, the way it is presently, and this is a fairly important idea, the way our life is presently being lived for us, it takes us away. It takes us out of that moment. It removes us from what is real so that we can have a sensation of ourselves as being someone or something that is in life. But here's the real point. You see, if you're in life, if you're really in life, you don't have to think about what you own. If you're really in life, you don't have to worry about what someone else is thinking about you. And you know why? You have your hands full. You have your... This is such a nice thought. I wish that there were better ways to say this. Your spiritual hands are full when you are in the present moment. Because in the present moment, you are actually a part of and a place through which everything is moving. The three streams that I talked about have to do with the heart, the mind, and the body. That all of the energies that animate a human being, all of the possibilities of a human being being happy, content, whole, and more important than any of that, transformed. We are trying to transform our own lives through an outcome-oriented life. Can you put that together? Can you think what that means? In other words, I'm trying to change the way I feel about myself. I'm trying to change what I am and who I am by figuring out what has moved through me and now past me.
Hear Guy Finley in person. Guy lives and teaches in Merlin, Oregon, where he speaks four times each week at beautiful nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. Visit us anytime and hear Guy's life-transforming principles in a friendly, serene, and inspiring environment. Visit GuyFinley.org or call 541-476-1200 to learn more about friendly ongoing classes. You are not alone in your quest for a new life. At Life of Learning, you'll meet others who are also seeking higher understanding, and you'll experience the power and inspiration of hearing Guy Finley in person. Plan to visit us and take the next step in your spiritual development. For information, call 541-476-1200, 541-476-1200, or visit GuyFinley.org. That's GuyFinley.org.
Do you agree that look at a tree, you take a tree. Could a tree rise as it rises if it weren't first an invisible stream of energies producing the conditions under which the tree takes shape? Yes or no? It couldn't. It is the creative energies, it is the energy of life, the radiant energy, the earth energy, all of those things pouring in to what's first just a little tiny seed. All these energies pouring in a little tiny seed, they'll see all the seed. Yeah, you think I'm kidding? Oh, a little seed, boy, I got, whoa, pop. Sprig comes up. Whoa, energy leaves. I'm not kidding you. All of those energies of life itself pouring into that thing and forming a thing from the energies. The thing is the outcome of the energies. And it is the things that we see, that we measure ourselves and know ourselves through, when it is the energies and the incoming of that is intended not to just define us, but to produce in us that which gives us real life, which allows us to learn to express those energies instead of trying to control their outcome so that we control what we call our lives. How many of you can see the difference in what I'm talking about? The only way that a person can begin to move through what we're talking about is this process of where, because we're talking about where the rivers of real life converge in us, well, they converge in the present moment. Where else would they converge? Everything converges in the now, doesn't it? If it weren't for this now life, this energy of now, of the present moment, I tell you, this is the truth, you wouldn't be breathing. We often laugh at this. If it was left up to you to remember to breathe, there'd be no one on the planet. If it was up to you to sustain the heartbeat, the electrical energy that allows you the simple awareness of the area around you, there'd be nothing. So all of this energy converges in the present moment. And we stand, if we can understand it, in that present moment. How? What is it that's required of us to be in this place where these rivers converge? I mean, let me ask you this. Because I'm not aware of it, does it mean it's not happening? It's happening. It's just not happening for me, meaning I'm not living from that. What must I do to live in the now? I have to learn to let go. Let go of what? Let go of what? Question. If somebody, let's say you saw somebody and they're walking up to your front door and they had this big brick of gold. How many wish that was true? Mm-hmm. Big brick of gold. Here's a big brick of gold. Could you know what happened? Ah, a reward. I can go buy that thing. I can do that. A reward. And as they got closer, first you're all in. As you got closer, you could see like a chip on the side and there was lead underneath it. How many of you would think to yourself, "Oh, gold"? How many of you say, "Oh, come in, bring that lead of load into my house"? Would you have any problem letting go of the sense of yourself that a moment before was all filled with all of this wonderful sense of yourself? Would you have any problem with that? Why? I could see the thing was useless. I could see absolutely that there was nothing in that. How about this? How do you lose interest in someone who's betrayed you? That sounds stupid, doesn't it? You don't, in quotes, lose interest in someone who's betrayed you. You see that there's absolutely no value in continuing and having interest in who's betrayed you. Of course, we don't even get that, do we? So, learning to let go and live in the now begins with a person beginning to recognize that something in them is holding on to what it wants to hold on to for its own purposes. There's no other way. And not only is it holding on to what it's holding on to, all of the dreams, the aspirations, the disappointments too, by the way, the regrets, the fears, all of the things that your mind on a day-to-day basis cultivates, collects, and sits in a manner of speaking. If you could see it, it's a fairly ugly picture, but it's necessary. Here's a person, and they sit in like a miser with gold coins, pouring through what has failed to fulfill them. Can you see it in your mind's eye? It's not pretty, is it? Because the more that it fails to do that, the more they think they have to have that. That's what greed is, people. Greed is when a person finds out that what they have won't give them the contentment they're looking for. So the same mind that said fulfillment rested in possessing things then says the answer is to possess more of what didn't fulfill me the first time. And that's why the world staggers the way it does. So our task is beginning to understand this whole process of, well, I want to be alive. I want a real life. And to have a real life, I have to be where real life is happening. The incoming moment. Think of it. Now change. We have to do something. I want you to feel for a moment. I want you to come wide awake. And I want you to actually kind of, as best you can understand it, take part in the incoming moment. Feel it. Be aware of it. To be present to the incoming moment simply requires that one let go of being identified with their own thoughts about what just transpired. Because I can't have what is if my mind is all the time with what was. And it is what is that changes a human being. Because why? Why is it that it is what is that changes a human being? Please listen to this. Because what is always changing itself. God's life is always perfecting itself. God's life is always enlarging itself. God's life is always clarifying itself. God's life is always helping itself go higher, even though it sounds like a contradiction. And that's all what it means to understand that there's no moment in which, wherever I am, that the grain that I'm cutting into, and what does it mean to cut into it? It means to be alive. See, you don't understand that. Just to be alive, you're cutting into the grain. Just to be a human being is the possibility of being an individual who, wherever he is, wherever she is, moment to moment, to recognize that that moment that is moving through me, that those streams that have converged where I am, that not only am I a part of that convergence, but I am myself changed by the convergence. Because the waters, as they move, change themselves, and my awareness of those changing waters is the same as the changing of myself. And more beautiful than that is that I don't need to be concerned one bit. I need have no fear whatsoever about what those waters are doing. As opposed to what I am now, which is someone who's trying to control every bit of water that goes anywhere so that I can have a little puddle to drink from later, or whatever it is that one construes as being significant to themselves. These things are not easily put. But I can assure you that if you're at all interested in divining, in understanding what the difference is between the way we are now, which is so terribly dry, untouchable hearts because they've closed themselves off in the fear of losing what they've imagined their life is, what their rewards are, and become, to give you an exercise, we talked once a long time ago about this, to understand the difference between being willful and watchful. The willful life is the life that's concerned solely with the outcome of things, isn't it? I will this, I will that, I want that, I want that. Why? Because I want to produce an outcome that when it is in my hand, when it is in my mind, that when an outcome is there, I will know I've succeeded according to what I believe will make me happy. That's a willful life. A watchful life is a life in which a person begins to understand that the meaning of his or her existence, the meaning of his or her existence cannot be found in this world as it is. The meaning of your existence cannot be found in this world as it is. And this world as it is not the planet that we look out there upon, but the world as it is the world that every one of us shares in common with a mind that produces an image for the sake of filling itself with the sensations that image holds. That world is an empty world. It's a part of this world. It's something that we can live with and understand. But to try to find what it takes to participate in real life in a world that's necessarily separated from it by its own actions is a recipe for punishment, a recipe for sadness, a recipe for the kind of, if you will, sorrow that human beings feel on a day-to-day basis that then they turn around and deny. Have you ever caught yourself doing that? Something goes wrong. You thought something was going to make you very happy. Something would work out and at last you'd have that sense of yourself you wanted, and then it didn't turn out like that. And instead of seeing that the purpose itself was grounded in what couldn't have done what it said it would do, we come up with another purpose. Come up with a way to redefine ourselves so that we can get past that moment and what turns out to be nothing other, listen to me, nothing other than our denial of life itself. If you will, if you're interested, try to remember that any time that you want to, you can shift your attention from the thoughts that have come up with images and dreams, that those thoughts that are always, what man taking thought, always coming up with tomorrows, always coming up with excuses and justifications for yesterdays. Anytime you want to, you can do it right now. You can take your attention away from that nature and bring it right into the grain, right into the convergence of these rivers that I'm telling you about. And I know that one of the problems is that we don't really understand yet that these rivers of life, of God's light, we don't really understand they exist. We can use a part of our mind to kind of conceive that they must, but our senses deny to us the existence of an invisible world and those beautiful forces that sustain it. Of course our senses deny us access to that. Our senses want us to remain slaves to their life. Our senses are the source of the outcome-oriented life because they judge everything accordingly. We have parts of us that can begin to understand that it's possible for us to be right there at the headwaters where these three rivers of life meet, and that we can be washed clean by them, we can be refreshed by them, and we can be enriched by them. All we have to do is begin to recognize that we need a new purpose, which comes with having seen that the meaning that we're living from turns out to be meaningless, and then watch what happens. You've been invited there now. You've been told what it means to let go and live in the now. Now it's up to you to start living like that.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation, visit guyfinley.com, where you'll find a host of free, life-changing information. Thanks for joining us today.
Love, the brightest and most powerful force in the universe. Love melts stress and cancels resentment. It gives birth to kindness and is the fuel of success. Love is at the heart of every great relationship and is the true essence of lasting peace. In his new book, Apprentice of the Heart, best-selling author Guy Finley explores lessons in life only love can teach. This breakthrough book contains the tools you need to strengthen and deepen all of your relationships with family, friends, coworkers, and with the present moment itself. Apprentice of the Heart, available now at guyfinley.com and fine bookstores everywhere. Joseph Polansky of Diamond Fire magazine writes, "The reader is lifted up to a whole new realm, a rarefied region of the soul." To order your copy of Guy Finley's Apprentice of the Heart, visit guyfinley.com. That's guyfinley.com. The relationship your heart longs for already exists.